Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans.
Oh, give it a rest. You're under new management. It's Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast now.
Hello, and welcome to our latest podcast, and what a treat we've got for you today. There'll be no messing about because this is just the most amazing subject we've got. And who is it, Gary? What are we doing? Why is it so interesting? What's so good about it?
Well, we're talking about one person today, and that person is Graham Donald. Now, a lot of people may not have heard of Graham Donald, but it is an exciting tale of derring do and the early days of aviation.
It is. But just an outline, just so you don't go away after we've said that, because I know how easily bored our listeners are. He's an officer in the Royal Naval Air Service. He was on coastal defence patrols around Britain, 1915. He served aboard HMS Engadine at the Battle of Jutland. He worked on testing and evaluating the Sopwith Camel, the famous First World War scout. And then posted out to No. 2 Wing Royal Naval Air Service, where he was operating in the Aegean, often from Imbros, where we've been, Gary. You know, one of our. In fact, that's where you had dysentery or Bain's disease. And there's a famous photograph of you going into or just coming out of a latrine. Mm. Do you remember?
Yes, I do. Luckily, Graham Donald's from Edinburgh, which means we can just do our normal accents because obviously he's English.
Yes, well, everyone from Edinburgh is English, as we know. Now, what is this based on? Oh yes, and finally, we ought to mention Graham Donald was involved in the attempt to sink the Goeben in January 1918.
Goeben or Goeben? I
never
know.
Goeben.
Oh, Goeben. Not
Goeben. I don't know.
Oh. Okay. That was in January 1918, wasn't it?
It was. Now, This is not based on an interview I did. This is an interview based on my old boss, David Lance, and the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. And he recorded it way back in 1972, which is 8 years before I joined the War Museum. We'll mention it again at the end, but you can listen to the whole interview on the War Museum website. I'd type in Graham Donald. Graham spelled G-R-A-H-A-M-E. And Donald, spelt Donald. Now, let's talk. So when was he born? He was born, Graham Donald, not you, was born in 6th of June, 1891. He was the son of a doctor. He was educated at Dulwich College, and there he excelled at rugby, and he played in a team that contained no less than 5 future internationals for various countries. He then went to University College Oxford, selected as a prop. What is a prop?
Something to do with rugby.
And he played for Scotland against Wales and then Scotland against Ireland. So he didn't change sides. He was brilliant
That was in 1914, wasn't it?
It was. And then guess what ended his rugby career?
Oh, well, presumably the war. Don't mention the war.
We'll not mention it again at all. His real interest, though, was aircraft, and that's something that it began really early on in life. And This is what's quite amazing to me and you about this, isn't it? You wanted to say a bit about this.
Well, just bear in mind, we're talking about a man who, in 1914, flight had only been around for 11 years. It wasn't something that had been around years and years and years and developed. It was right at the cusp of technology. And he got involved very, very early, didn't he?
He was captivated by the Wright brothers and also the Blériot. I mean, it's unbelievable, but just 5 years before was the crossing of the Channel by Blériot in 1909.
The old joke would be then, if he was captivated by the Wright brothers, did they let him go?
It's a very old joke.
Very, very old joke.
And one ideally suited to your personality, talents as a comedian. His interest came to a bit of a peak in 1910, where he attends the Lanark Aviation Meeting. And that's the last accent we're doing, because we're going to be respectful to this man in Scotland. And then, during the first Circuit of Britain race, one of its turning points, where the aircraft sort of changed course and basically landed for a bit, was at Paisley Racecourse, which was nearby his home in Renfrewshire. And here he met aviation pioneer Samuel Cody.
Oh, I thought the world of him. I mean, he's deliberately dressed like his cousin Buffalo Bill Cody, cowboy hat and little beard and moustache. And we expected him to produce a lasso at any moment, but he didn't actually do that. But he's an awfully nice chap, and he had a look at my big scale model I was making of an Antoinette monoplane that I rather liked. I remember him saying, looking at my ailerons, balanced ailerons, one went down and the other up, and he said, no, my boy, warp the wings, imitate the birds, my boy, imitate the birds. And at that time, I didn't know that quite soon every plane would have balanced ailerons, but still, I liked them because they were easier to make.
So there we are. So Donald Cody was a relative of Buffalo Bill Cody, and it's all jolly interesting, that, I think.
Well, it's funny to think of people meeting these people. You just think of these people as sort of stars of screen, really, like a made-up individual, but it's a real human being.
And I like about that, of course, the expert, Cody, has, of course, it completely wrong. Warping the wings is not the way forward, and balanced ailerons are the way to go. Not that I know what a balanced aileron, I can't say it either, what a balanced aileron is if it bashed me on the head.
Now, his father was opposed to him being involved in flight, wasn't he? But
why would that be? Come on, then. Why do you think that might be,
Gary? Well, because he's bloody dangerous, I would have thought. And despite his father's opposition, he managed to get a flight with Cody, didn't he? Managed to get up.
Before setting off, Cody did take a trial flight to test the weather from the race course, so I did have a passenger flight with him in 1911. Terrific thrill, of course, first time in the air, and a good look at the surrounding fields. We didn't go up very high. I don't suppose we went up more than about 300 feet at most and did one wide circuit. We had a look at the weather and had a look at some of the high hills to the south, which were nearly 500 feet high, which seemed quite high in those days.
So that's great stuff. Just the idea of that first flight with Cody. It's amazing to think of. And then, a bit later, he has a real bit of luck, doesn't he? As far as aviation goes, it's the sort of luck you had early in your life as well, isn't it? What was it, Gary?
This is what Graham Donald says. My father died in 1913, and I'm afraid he would have stopped me if he'd been alive. But very, very shortly afterwards, I was able to buy from a chap at Brooklands an alleged Blériot-type monoplane. Quite a good job. Built by the Humber Motor people, called the Humber Blériot. And it was a very good copy of the Blériot. Just shortly before the end of 1913, I'd made one or two straight hops, managed to get up and make a landing of sorts in the next field. So hang on a minute. So his father dies and he buys a plane.
Next day sort of thing, yes. His poor dad. I love this concept of just, you've got an aeroplane, you don't know how to fly it, and you just take off in. Oh, God.
But again, let's bear in mind here, this is 1913. Flight had only been established for 10 years, powered flight.
It's a dangerous business, a dangerous business.
Well, of course, very few people could train you. You just had to train yourself in those days. I mean, you either taught yourself or you broke your neck. It was really quite a simple process. Well, flying is quite simple if you do it carefully. But I didn't fly very far, but the fact remains I flew the thing, and I did actually have a very mild half-turnover into a hedge and broke my one propeller, which was a pity. That was in the spring of 1914.
Now, I think he's lucky to survive some of these things, don't you? Before he had any proper training. But then he's lucky enough to get a bit of an outside help, isn't he? And you've got another quote from Donald that sort of explains how he got his very first flying training.
Major Gordon of the Royal Marine Light Infantry, who was then a member of what was called the RFC Naval Wing, asked me to come through and stay with them at Leven on the coast of Fife. And he took me up once or twice, very kindly, and highly unofficially took me on one or two passenger flights in a converted short seaplane, which had been converted into a fine old land machine. A short number 42 with dual control. He gave me some dual instruction, unofficially. I enjoyed that tremendously, and it certainly gave me an inkling, a better inkling, into this question of landing a plane.
Now, he's making a bit of progress then, wasn't he? He's sort of gradually picking things up. But it's not formal training. This is picking up things up. This is getting a little bit of an idea of what he should be doing. He was pretty confident about it, though, wasn't he?
Oh, at that time, I probably thought I was pretty good. But at this distance, I can assure you, I was kidding myself. It really takes an appreciable number of hours in the air to learn to fly a plane properly. But, I mean, at that time, I was quite capable of taking a plane off the ground and assuming it was a reasonable-sized field, of putting it back into a field again without crashing. Without, we used to say in the old days that any landing you could walk away from was a good one.
Now, so we're at the point now where war's approaching, isn't it? And what does Donald decide to do?
It was pretty obvious that there was a war coming along anyway, so the matter required some thought. Because the point is, the only thing I was very keen on in those days was flying. The war certainly added a spice of fun to it, or so we thought. In the family, we've had a certain amount of naval connections, and the naval side appealed to me.
So what he was going to go for was the Royal Naval Air Service, RNAS. But how to get into that? Well, the first thing he did is he went to Hendon Aerodrome, and there were private flying schools that were operating. It was a naval sort of aerodrome as well. And they were operating with the permission of the Navy, who basically just wanted as many pilots trained as possible. They weren't that bothered how they did. And Donald enrolls in the Beatty School of Flying in October 1914.
Got started training on his dual control Wright biplane, a genuine American Wright biplane, twin propellers, chain driven, one of them with a cross chain, which makes most engineers shudder. Completely inherently unstable. A lot of people used to say later on, if you could fly a Wright biplane, you could fly anything. Well, the fact remains it flew, but it had no front elevator. It was a dead spit of the ones that the Wright brothers first took off at Kitty Hawk in the United States. Speed range, I should think, was about 3 knots, and probably flew level at about 42 knots. Began diving at 43, installed at 39 or 40, so you hadn't really much to play about with. The instrumentation was quite simple. There was a length of fine cords about 18 inches long tied to one of the struts in front of you. You kept your eye on the cords, and the idea being if they went sideways, you were side-slipping, and if they cord suddenly went limp, the only thing to do was to sing "Nearer My God to Thee."
Now, I think that quote gives us an idea of how dangerous it is, doesn't it? "Nearer My God to Thee." If only I knew the tune, I'd sing it. But sadly, I'm a bit down on my...
That's never stopped you before.
But he also gets some experience on the Cowdron tractor biplane. Now, I love the quote that follows because I could picture it in my mind's eye because I live in this area. I live in East Finchley, which is, and I often walk through this area, which is by the North Circular past the North Circular up onto where the Royal Air Force, RAF Museum is. And that's where this incident takes place, which is Hendon, yeah. And this is, well, here we go.
We're flying out just a bit beyond the Midland Railway Line, which runs from St Pancras to the north, just beyond the railway line, and the engine cut completely. I found out later the tank was empty, but that wasn't my fault, because I was supposed to be the pupil. So the pilot's name was Jimmy James, grabbed his control stick and immediately put our nose down, because the Codron biplane had a gliding angle like a brick, started pointing us straight for the drone. But there was rather a toss-up whether we'd clear the railway line. At that moment, there were two express trains coming, one heading for Scotland, the other heading for St Pancras. It was a bit of a toss-up which we'd arrive at. Now, we just managed to jerk her up through the smoke, got over the railway line, and by the time we reached the field on the other side, she'd stalled at a height of about 5 or 6 feet up, and so the Codron did its normal neat little dive and turned upside down with its wheels in the air. It was a sort of conventional way for Codrons to land. It didn't do much harm to the plane. Then we both tumbled out and undid our belts and tumbled out of our seats, and nobody was any the worse, but it felt quite terrific.
That's pretty exciting. I like that idea. That was the sort of conventional way of a Codron to land.
Yeah, upside down. Yeah. And just missing the trains by about 5-6 feet. God, Jesus.
I remember when I first heard that, when I was, I was writing a book, Tumult in the Clouds. And I remember listening to that and thinking, wow, that's bloody exciting.
But also having the presence of mind to take in the fact that there was two express trains, one going north, one going south. I mean, he's taking all that in at a time when, frankly, he's at risk of death.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Now, during his training, he makes a formal approach to join the RNAS. He's paying for his flying training at this stage. I think they reimburse it, a bit of it. But what does he say next, Gary?
The Admiralty accepted me, passed the medical test and all that, and given working kit and uniform. The only thing I remember was filling in a form marked religion. I wasn't quite sure what to put, so I just wrote Christian. He grinned and said, "All His Majesty's officers in His Majesty's Navy are supposed to be that. You're supposed to put down the sect you belong to." I said, "Oh, yes," and I made it Church of Scotland.
So not that religious,
well, it's
then.
Definitely a sect. Oh, hang on, just insulted the Church of Scotland. I take that back.
Church, a wonderful body of men and women, I believe you, meant to say. Now, meanwhile, his training's going on at the Beatty Flying School. It's quite... I love the test. You're going to tell us now. Tell us a bit about the training he went through at the Beatty Flying School.
Beatty had his own methods of training, which were very careful. He didn't want to have his plane crashed. It may sound pretty appalling nowadays, but his system was to give you concentrated dual control until he reckoned you were ready to take your pilot's ticket. And then he turned you loose solo, and you took your ticket on your first solos. I didn't actually go for my pilot's ticket until the 30th of January 1915. You took the plane off, and you made 5 figures of 8 covering the entire airfield. You didn't get very high, probably a matter of 150 feet or so, but it did make sure that you could do both left and right-hand turns, and keep them more or less round what we called the pylons, which marked the edge of the aerodrome. And after you'd done your 5 figures of 8, you'd bring her into the centre of the airfield and land her and come to rest within a given distance of a mark, which was the test inspector's oilskin coat. It was really quite a good test. Managed to take it all right. My number is, if I remember rightly, 1,061. Just 61 over the 1,000, which was most annoying.
His training had been delayed a bit by a smashed up aircraft, and that's the list of pilots. That's all the pilots there were at the time. It gives you an idea. It's hundreds of thousands of pilots now, I expect. So he gets his ticket, as they called it, in February 1915, and he's posted as flight sub lieutenant to East Church Airfield. Isn't that near where your holiday mansion is, Gary?
Don't know. Not sure.
Well. And he went more training, this time on the short biplane, and he also the short pusher biplane, I should have said. And he almost flew semi-operational flights, because while he was learning, they said, well, you might as well keep an eye on the Thames Estuary and off the coast, looking for submarines and anything suspicious.
So what's a pusher, Pete? That's with the engine and the propeller behind.
That's right, and it sort of pushes you along. A bit like a jet, only a bit more primitive. Although, of course, it wasn't primitive then. It was the most advanced technology. Yeah. And all the time, he's learning navigational skills, although navigation in those days was a lot looking over the side.
Yeah, where am I?
That big splashy thing looks like the sea, and that other splashy thing must be the Thames. I think that's about the level of it. He then went, the same month, February 15, he was only to Eastchurch a week or two. He was sent to RNAS Eastbourne, and there he flew various tractor aircraft. Now, tractor aircraft is where the propeller's at the front. So what we would expect a propeller aircraft to be, if you see what I mean, to the modern mind.
And that pulls the plane along, then, presumably, rather than pushes it.
Yeah, I presume so. Yes, yes. God, you're so technical. That's very good. And he went on various escort patrols with merchant ships in the Channel. But nothing much happens. And that's one of the things about escort.
Yeah, I was going to say, what could they do at that time? They couldn't do a great deal, could they, from the air?
I remember Dad telling me that post boxes were to frighten elephants. And I said, you what? I've never seen an elephant. He says, that's because the post box is working. And I think that's the idea of these patrols, really. Anyway, he then went to, where did he go there? Calshot. He goes March 1915, so he's, again, not long. He goes to Calshot, where he's learning to fly seaplanes. Now, what are seaplanes, Gary?
Well, I'm assuming it's the same as today. These are aircraft that take off and land on the sea, where they have sort of big floats on the bottom, like skis and things.
That's precisely right. And this is what I'm going to be Donald this time. And this is what he says. The first problem was to get the things unstuck off the water. Sometimes you were dashed lucky if you got a seaplane off in 3 miles. If the water was a bit calm, you could go half the length of the Solent before you got off. And even then, when you got off, the climb was appalling. The first time you land a seaplane, you don't realise the water is hard. The first time I just said to myself, oh God, I've overshot the beach. I've landed on concrete. It really is a shock the first time you land on small waves to find out how hard they are. And to give that some context, this is like you, Gary, belly flopping off a diving board. It can be quite painful, can't it?
Yes, Pete.
And splashy. So he's then posted to his first operational, having learnt to fly seaplanes, he's posted to his first operational seaplane station. And that's in far off Dundee. Now, that is a wild, primitive place in Scotland. And it's also the heart of Fifty Four Far country, Gary. And the Fifty Four Far's coming to stay, the Fifty Four Far's. Where he was flying Avro and Short seaplane biplanes. And he was on submarine patrols. Now, give me an idea of what a submarine patrol is. They're in the North Sea. What's he doing?
He's looking for submarines.
Yes, because submarines, how could he see them?
Well from the air. I mean, again, submarines are pretty primitive at the time. And they, you know, they have to come up quite frequently. And they could be spotted from the air. And then, you know, destroyers and other shipping in the area could be called in to attack the submarine. It wouldn't be the plane attacking the submarine. They would be spotting.
Now, while he was at Dundee, he met a real character. And that's Christopher Draper, known as the Mad Major.
It was Christopher Draper, then a flight lieutenant, and who was, in my opinion, undoubtedly the world's finest pilot, and remained that for a good many years. A few years later on the Western Front, he used to call him the Mad Major. What he was doing on seaplanes, I don't know, but he could do anything with any sort of plane. His great specialty was he could take a plane through quite a relatively narrow opening, you know, like taking a bicycle through a narrow gateway or something of that sort, and it's not just so easy as it looks. And he used to fly quite regularly through the Tay Bridge, which is not like the Forth Bridge, the Tay Railway Bridge. It was built on stone pillars, quite reasonably wide apart, but he used to fly through that quite gaily. And one day he challenged me to follow him through, so I followed behind him, just a comfortable distance behind. As he went through, it struck me that he had that's little clearance at his wingtips. There's very little clearance. It struck me that wasn't enough for me anyway. So I may as well admit it here and now. I functioned at the last moment and just pulled I was in the old short biplane, and just pulled her right up and went over the bridge and not through. So when we got back to the station, Christopher said, "Well, you managed it all right." I had to admit to him, I funked it. And he said, What? I said, "No, I funked it." He said, "Why?" Well, I said, "What clearance did you have at your wingtips?" "Oh," he said, "about a foot and a half, I should think, each wing. 3 feet overall." Well, I said, "You know, from a rough guess, I think the old short seaplane's 5 or 6 feet wider in span than the Avro, which you're flying. We could go and measure it, but I think I'm right. If I hadn't funked it, you know, well, I'd have knocked the tables down and you'd have got the blame."
Now, that's a hell of a story, isn't it, Gary? I mean, the idea of flying through the Tay Bridge is just madness. And I like the idea of him approaching the bridge thinking, yeah. Why does that? Hang on.
When I was a bus driver, I used to approach low bridges and it would say, you know, 14 foot six. I used to drive along thinking, oh, I wonder how tall my bus is. Similar thing, I suppose.
So, anyway, that's a great story. And he was famous for it. He also flew under the Thames Bridges. He did all sorts of things. And he, I'd say, known as a mad major on the Western Front, although there's lots of people who know that. Now, Donald is then detached, just briefly, with a couple of aircraft, to the former RFC station at Montrose, where he's flying conventional aeroplane, on more routine patrols over the Firth of Forth and the Firth of Tay. That's the splashy thing near Edinburgh and the splashy thing near Dundee, I think, if those of you are geographically challenged. And he goes on to say this, and this is the point I was making earlier, I think. Coastal patrol work was utterly essential. The enemy knew just as well as our people that these patrols were being carried out. If we'd been carrying out no aircraft patrols, I don't know what they might have been up to. They might have come to regard the North Sea as theirs. The mere fact that you're known to be carrying out what looks to be a constant patrol, the actual times you saw the enemy were damn few and far between. It was a game of cat and mouse in the North Sea. Now, there's something else they're trying to intercept. Can you imagine what that might be, Gary? At this stage of the war, pushing into 16.
Yeah, it's going to be Zeppelins. There were Zeppelins attacks across the country, including Edinburgh, actually. So it would be Zeppelins. Although, to be honest, at that time, it was a bit of a fruitless task, wasn't it?
Well, and this next, I think he's going to tell us about this.
The Zeppelin alarm usually came during the night, because Zeppelins only came over in the hours of darkness. It was rather absurd, but well, to please everybody, you had to put on a show of going out to chase Zeppelins. I mean, you had about as much chance of, in those days when there was no radar, no anything, weren't even any night landing facilities, you had as much chance of spotting a Zeppelin in the dark as a blind man catching a black cat in the Albert Hall in the dark. You could take off, hoping to goodness the sun would rise before you ran out of petrol, because it was just too bad if you had to make a landing. We didn't have any night landing facilities, but I was very lucky. The few times I had to go out at night, the dawn had broken, so you were able to see what you were landing on. Otherwise, it was a bit awkward.
I like that description of looking for a black cat, a blind man looking for a black cat in the Albert Hall. But the idea of hoping that you'll be able to land in daylight, because there is nothing you can do at night. You can't see the ground. You can't see anything. And I love the understatement of it would have been a bit awkward. A bit awkward as in fatal, I expect. Now, by this time, Donald's getting bored. He's getting bored of this life or death existence. And he puts in for sea time, and he's posted aboard the seaplane carrier HMS Engadine. Now, HMS Engadine is a converted, she's one of the first aircraft carriers, but she's basically a cross-channel ferry that's been converted. That's all she is. Big lumpy thing, not exactly a glamorous thing. Forget all the flat.
But they're not like today. Flat. It's not, you know, in your imagination, you think of an aircraft carrier with a huge flat area that they take off from. It's nothing like that, is it?
No, no. They're basically put out on cranes. They're stored inside and put out on cranes.
I've seen pictures with them having the wings folded up as well. Presumably that all had to be lowered before you took off.
Spec so. Now, the HMS Engadine was based in the Firth of Forth. That's the splashy bit near Edinburgh.
Near Edinburgh, yeah.
He goes there in October 1915. And his job, the job of the Engadine, rather, was to accompany the battlecruiser fleet or squadron under Beatty, Admiral Sir David Beatty, who's a complete arse. Listen to our Jutland thing and you'll find out about him. But
Made his own uniforms.
Yeah, brave officer, competent officer, just an unpleasant person, really. He would accompany them when they went on a North Sea sweep. And this is, again, they sweep into the North Sea because the North Sea is contested water and they try not to let the Germans get a grip on it because then it would be German water. So that's what they're doing. What aircraft does she carry, Gary?
It's the Schneider Cups with single-seater, I think.
So they've got two of them and short seaplanes, the ones you mentioned with the wings folded.
Yeah, they're the ones where the wings fold up.
Sorry, you'd already said
that. You can see that on the internet if anybody's interested. There are lots of pictures of that if you search.
They're good fun, aren't they?
Yeah.
And here's a quote from Donald. Each seaplane was on a trolley, but with its wings folded. They were wheeled out on the aft deck. My momentary pirate feelings came out there. The wings were opened out, all the pins put in, wire bracings coupled up, engine got going and warmed up. Meanwhile, the crane swung inboard and the hook was put into a sling on the seaplane's top plane. You hooked on, the crane hove you up a few feet clear of the deck, swung you over the side and lowered you into the water. As soon as your floats touched the water, you got rid of the hook and the chaps aloft got it up, out of the way, in case it fouled your propeller. Then it was just like any other seaplane takeoff.
even just getting the seaplane onto the sea sounds incredibly dangerous. I mean, the amount of things that could go wrong. And particularly if the weather's bad.
Now, we've not got much about this. So it's a lot of routine, but there's one day when it isn't routine, is it? And it's the 31st of May, 1916. What happens then? Why does that date stick in my mind, Gary?
I have no idea.
I don't know. The podcast.
It's the Battle of Jutland, Pete, which I think is just by Lowestoft, isn't it?
Yeah, I always said it was. I wanted to do a battlefield tour based off of Jutland. And get lots of people to pay money to come to Southwold Pier, which is a very small pier. We'd stand at the end and I'd point in my usual fashion and say, "Over those waves!" And point vaguely. You know that wave where you don't really know where something is. Anyway, now Donald was nearly a key player in this battle, wasn't he? He was nearly the man who was sent off. Nearly the man who was sent off in the sea. Nearly, Gary. Is that nearly?
Nearly. But then fate intervenes, doesn't it?
I'm perfectly certain that David Beatty knew very well where the enemy fleet was, but what he wanted to know is how many ships there were and what could have consisted of, details of what was just over the horizon there. And all we had to do was to go and find out and report back. And it happened to be my very good luck to be my turn purely on the rotor to carry out that very interesting flight. Word came to investigate with aircraft. They were just over the horizon in the direction of Schleswig-Holstein, sitting in the cockpit waiting for instructions, engine warming up, all clad in flying gear, chain hooked on, ready to hoist. We'd have been in the water and away in about a minute and a half. And just as I got my engine nicely warmed up, unfortunately, a senior flying officer, Flight Lieutenant Rutland, appeared, waved me down, and my observer, and told me that he got the captain's sanction that he was to go. So my old short seaplane, H359, away she went, but without us.
So his plane, but not him.
Yeah, and so Lieutenant Rutland is incredibly famous, and his nickname was Rutland of Jutland.
Oh, that's when he... no.
So it could have been Donald of Jutland.
No, but that's why they sent Rutland. Somebody went up there and said, wouldn't it be good if we send Rutland out, because this is Jutland?
Oh, dear. I love it when you may or may not know that that Rutland had a somewhat checkered career in the Second World War, where he was accused, I don't know whether it was justly or unjustly, of being a Japanese spy.
Oh, God.
I just like, but it's just wonderful to, when in the interview, David Land says, oh, perhaps you'd like to comment on Rutland's personality, what kind of a fellow he was, and you know, just generally about him. Donald says, no. Oh, touch of... the weather. Why doesn't he take off later? Why do they just send one plane off? Why does this matter?
Well, it makes it impossible for more flights. Bear in mind when we're talking about here, Peter.
What makes it impossible for more flights?
The weather. What? The weather. Bear in mind when we're talking about, it's difficult enough nowadays to take off and land in bad weather. Can you imagine doing it then?
Yeah, the waves, just you can't get any speed.
Yeah, you can't get any speed, you can't get up, and it makes landing impossible as well. So even if you're up, you know, you've got to think about getting down.
Or Dan.
Or Dan, yeah.
Now, so that his next post. It's all a bit of a nothing. If you listen to the tapes at the War Museum, which I do urge you to, there's lots of exciting stuff because the Engadine's involved in trying to rescue HMS Warrior, and he gives a good account of that. But that's not really the subject of our podcast. So I just say there's lots in the interview that isn't in this podcast. So it's a great interview. The War Museum did brilliantly to interview him.
Now, he next gets posted to RNAS Killing Home on the Humber Estuary. So he must have done something wrong to go near Hull.
Absolutely. Can you imagine? You go, where am I going? Where am I going? Hull.
Hull.
Oh. Hull.
Hull, yeah. Get your cool.
Aren't they Yorkshiremen around there?
They are Yorkshiremen.
And that must be East Yorkshiremen, which are particularly difficult, I believe.
Yeah. Although I often think of it as Humberside.
Do you? Have you told Yorkshire people?
No, I don't.
So what's he doing there, Gary?
Well, it, as we mentioned, he's got experience on the single-seater SOP with Schneider seaplanes. So he's
that's from when he was on the
Engadine. Yeah. So he's sent out to carry out evaluation tests on the new SOP with Camel, which is from April to July 1917.
Oh, wow. Well, that's the new...
And most people will have heard of the Sopwith Camel. It's probably the most famous aircraft of the period.
Arguably. And second only to the SE-5A, which was much better. Anyway, this is what he says. He disagrees with me. Unbelievable. It's as if he knows what he's talking about, whereas I don't. He says this. The Sopwith Camel was so quick to control. Far, far quicker than the Schneider Cup Sopwith. Quick to turn, good performance, wonderful manoeuvrability. For a dogfight, the perfect machine. Twin machine guns, Sopwith Cowper interrupter gear, with the guns firing through the propeller. He means through the arc of the propeller.
Yeah, not through the propeller. Yeah.
All the weights concentrated very close together. Engine, guns, pilot, tank. Everything very close, and a very small tail fin and rudder which didn't slow down your movement. She wasn't a machine that you wanted to be ham-handed with, but in my opinion, she was, and still is, the finest fighter ever designed by the hand of man. Well, controversial, that's a respected viewpoint of a pilot of the time.
He flew it.
And also, he's right about it, in a dogfight, it was brilliant because of the fast turn, rate of turn. The SC-5's more a killing machine for diving down and zooming back up. So that's interesting. Different perspectives. And that's a perspective of a man who actually flew the bloody thing. Or he sometimes flew it, as we'll find out.
Yes.
Now, so what happens to him next? Where are we going next with him? Well, he's sent out to the Aegean, where by this time, we've not been following his rank, but he's flight commander.
So he's doing well. Donald doing now. Well.
He's doing well. And he's initially in command of two flights of Sopwith Camels that are based at Imbros. Later on, they move all over the bloody place in the Aegean. Now, he has one experience in a camel that's utterly unbelievable. Now, sadly, in the interview, David Lance didn't record this, and this tale was, because otherwise we'd let you hear it in his own words. But so this is just attached to the transcript, and it's only attached to the transcript that's actually in the War Museum, not the one that's online. Gary, just tell us this amazing story.
I'd just completed a short patrol and was approaching our airfield at a height of slightly over 6,000 feet. I decided to try a new manoeuvre, which might prove useful in combat. Bearing in mind that a full loop is utterly useless in a fight, the new manoeuvre was to be a half loop, roll off the top and proceed in the opposite direction. I pulled her up into a neat half loop and was going slightly too slowly and tended to hang upside down. With an efficient safety belt, no trouble at all. But our standard belt was 100% non-safe. Mine simply stretched a little and I dived clean through it out of the cockpit. Hang on a minute, he's at 6,000 feet. Nothing but air between me and the ground. An embarrassing moment. The first...
I just want to pause you a minute.
He's fell and out of the plane.
And he's up. The aircraft's upside down. He's left the aircraft. Yeah, and he's now tumbling
he's
down.
Not in the plane.
And he says, say it again for me, Gary.
An embarrassing moment.
Just unbelievable. Sorry to interrupt you, Gary. Carry on.
The first 2,000 feet passed very quickly and Terra Firma looked damnably firmer. I couldn't see my faithful little camel, but I could hear her close on my heels. And suddenly, there she was, and I fell or sprawled back on. Fortunately, she was a biplane, so hanging on the top saved me from slithering straight through the propeller, glistening beautifully in the evening sunshine at 1,200 revs per minute.
Now, so that means the aeroplane's tumbled down with him and he's managed to fall onto and grab the top wing. But I love that. The propeller glistening beautifully. Sorry. So what happens next, Gary? I'm all agog.
Hanging on with my left hand, with one foot hooked into the cockpit, I managed to reach down with my right hand and pulled the control stick backwards to pull her gently out of her dive, now at 140 to 150 miles per hour. And noisy. This was fatal. She immediately went into a most appalling spin, and an inverted spin at that, the kind whose centrifugal force sends you outwards. Even with two hands on the top plane, I was slipping, with about 2,500 feet left.
So the aircraft's upside down and spinning, which means it's sort of rotating around its own axis, and he's clinging.
Remembering in time that everything was inverted, I just managed to get my right foot on the control stick and pushed it hard forwards. The camel stopped spinning in half a turn and went into a smooth glide, but upside down. It was now easy to reach down, or up, one hand and pull her gently down and round into a normal glide. I was now down to about 800 feet. An unusually good landing was made without one note of applause due to the total absence of spectators. Every man jack of the squadron having disappeared. Most mysterious. In a minute or so, heads began to appear all over the place, popping up like bunny rabbits from every hole. What had happened was that when you press the sole of your foot on a control stick, you also press both triggers. And the entire landscape had been liberally sprinkled with nickel-plated confetti, and very wisely, all the ground crews had dived as one man for every available ditch.
That is just the most amazing. I love the idea of bullets spraying all across the aircraft.
Can we just revisit this for a second? So he's upside down. He falls out of the aircraft at 6,000 feet. He's falling. The aircraft falls with him. Effectively arrives.
Because it's coming round in the loop. It's
coming round in the loop. Effectively arrives underneath him. He grabs hold of it. luckily missing the propeller. He then starts to control it with his foot.
Puts it into a spin.
Realises it's an inverted spin, so he corrects that. Does the best landing and then wonders why nobody's applauded. And it's because he's basically shot them on the way down. If you put that in a movie script, nobody would believe it.
You'd just say, that's bollocks, wouldn't you?
That is incredible. What a man.
Unbelievable story. Now, the next thing we're going to go on to another exciting incident. This is on the 17th of January, 1918. And two camels, one's piloted by our hero, Graham Donald, the other by Jeff Winker. And they're escorting a DH-9. That's a sort of, well, it's normally a bomber, a sort of bomber.
That's a de Havilland 9, isn't it?
That's it. You know these things, don't you? And he's on a minefield reconnaissance. And so here he goes. Our practice was to send one camel over low down with a DH-9 and the other watched them from about 6,000 to 7,000 feet. As everybody preferred the upper berth, Winker and I tossed for it, and I won. Our selected area was just off Suvla Bay and Anzac Cove, and I could see our two planes, that's the camel and the DH-9, zigzagging across the minefield. Also, watching our planes with a keen degree of interest were the occupants of a biggish German, Friedrichshafen two-seater. That's why you gave it.
Well done.
The observer was staring at them so eagerly through his binoculars that he never noticed my Sopwith camel sitting about 35 yards behind him, which was an error. I love this understatement. Absurd as it sounds, I simply hadn't the heart to obey the advice of the famous Wild West lawman Wyatt Earp to shoot them when they ain't looking, preferably in the back.
Sorry, so Wyatt Earp was from Cornwall. Sorry to interrupt. Yep.
Yes, he was. So I just let go about 15 or 20 rounds in the air well behind them. That's as a warning. That's ridiculous. Never in my life have I seen such a rapid reaction. The binoculars flew out of their owner's hands, obviously breaking their strap, and fell in the general direction of the Aegean. While the pilot must have rammed his control hard forward as the plane practically folded into an 80-degree dive. This was also an error. A straight dive with a camel behind you is always an error. It then became purely a matter of following the enemy plane down from about 6,000 feet, keeping right behind his fin and rudder, thereby laying a dead stymie for his rear gunner. He means the rudder fin and thing would be in the
in
way.
In the way, yeah, couldn't shoot.
In this position, the rear gunner cannot hit the head of the camel pilot without shooting his own tail off. If only I'd left it to him to explain. I'm an idiot. The closest he can get is within about 18 inches of the top of your head, which is as good as a mile. In the meantime, the Friedrichshafen was collecting 750 rounds per minute from each of the camel's twin Vickers guns. A bit of touch of the Jeremy Clarkson's there. Through and around its fuselage. Halfway down, about 3,500 feet, it was over. It went into a vertical dive, then slowly on its back, and various bits and pieces began to fall off. I was too busy levelling out very, very gently to see it actually strike the water. However, from 1,000 feet, I could see the wreckage still floating. Now, I looked this up in The Sky There, Battlefield 2 by Trevor Henshaw, our chum Trevor, you know Trev. And it's duly there, right date. So it's there it is on the 17th of January, 1918. He says Suda Bay. I'm not sure where Suda Bay is, but that could be that's why it's always interesting to check oral history. I make no comment on that. But what an exciting tale! He was a bloody lunatic to warn them there. That wouldn't go well on the Western Front. On the Western Front, the idea was definitely kill before you warn them.
With at least risk to yourself as possible. And so giving them a warning increases the risk.
Of course it does. Now, a couple of days later, just 2 days later, comes the greatest excitement of the Battle of Imbros. That's on the 19th of January, 1918. Now, what happens? Give us an outline of what happens. You can have a go, will you? What happens here? What's the outline?
Well, the Goeben and the Breslau sail at about 4 p.m. on the 19th of January, and they're launched into an attack on Imbros. And most people think that, you know, if you go to Gallipoli, that the battles of Gallipoli are 1915. But this took place in 1918. And actually, if you visit, I think one of the cemeteries has a number of gravestones, W Beach, from that period. So it's interesting to think it didn't just end in 1915. So the two ships launch an attack on Imbros itself, and they're shelling the shore installations. And they sink the monitors Raglan and the M28. And there are some fatalities as a result.
I've certainly seen the graves from the Raglan. There's quite a few of them at Derby Beach on Helles. So then they break off the engagement and head off for Mudros. Now, I'm not quite sure it's 4 a.m. or 4 p.m. But by 8:30, the Breslau's hit another mine, and that causes severe damage. The Goeben had already hit a mine that had done no damage at all, but now the Breslau's severely damaged, and they begin to try and make their way home. And this is sort of like the opportunity the RNAS pilots have been waiting for. That's why I'm beginning to think it's 4 o'clock in the morning. It seems much more sensible. I think I've made a mistake with putting PM. Do you think the pilots are at peak readiness, the RNAS pilots and Donald, Gary?
No, and Donald is actually going to explain why not.
Why? What could stop a pilot from being at peak readiness?
Let's see, shall we?
Quite a number of chaps were going home on leave, and we had a very successful party, which lasted until 1 or 2 a.m. And to everybody's horror, we were wakened up very early hours of the morning. Well, the shouts of the Goeben's out. You lie about 25 stricken miles away from where the Goeben was. So it was just a matter of all available planes, the bombers, which were already bombed up, and of course the Imbros bombers were ready to attack with bombs, got underway. It was a case of everybody for himself.
Booze. Booze, Gary.
So they're all hungover, basically.
Yeah. Anyway, so the RFC and the RNAS aircraft are all attacking the Goeben and the Breslau. There's aircraft from all over. Some are from Mudros, some are from Imbros. They're from the Ark Royal and the Empress. They're aircraft carriers,
aren't they? Yep.
And Donald eventually gets a Sopwith Camel and joins in the attack. And you're going to take up the story because here.
With no German fighters appearing, just for the hell of it, we attacked with machine guns, pelting everything we could at them. Merely as a gesture, but it was quite funny to see machine gun bullets bouncing off conning towers. It couldn't do much harm unless you could shoot somebody through a slit. Anything you could do to rattle them, raking the decks with tracer. The Breslau hit several mines and began to sink most convincingly. So we concentrated on the Goeben, and she hit at least two. Being a heavier armoured ship, she didn't show such signs of distress, but she slowed down and began to settle a bit lower in the water. By the time they reached the mouth of the Dardanelles, the Goeben was going slowly and the Breslau had sunk. It wasn't our bombs that had sunk her, but we bombed her onto the minefield, so we claimed it as an RNAS victory.
Hooray! Poor old Breslau. A lot of people were killed on that ship, actually, and perhaps less hooray from me. There's destroyers after them as well, and the Goeben now ran into another minefield. Just as she turns, you know where you turn to enter the Dardanelles Strait, she hits another mine, and she takes on a really bad list to port, some 15 degrees over to port, which is a lot for a shippy thing. And you're going to take up the story as she goes on.
We followed the Goeben up the straits. Machines were going back and forwards from Mudros and Lemnos, loading up with every bomb they could get, coming back over and pelting away. The Goeben was going slower and slower, and by the time she was halfway up from Cape Helles to Chanak, we thought she was just on the verge of sinking. The only thing they could do, and they did it brilliantly, was beach her as fast as they could at Nagara Point, which is just at the Hellespont on a very suitable sloping beach, which allowed her to sit there without sinking, absolutely stuck solid. Now, again, we've been there, haven't we?
We have, because you could see it from one of the hotels we stay at, where we were on that breakfast balcony. You can look across towards the Nagara Point. And when we go, we climb up to what they call the German signal station, which are called a German battery. You're exactly opposite the Nagara Point. There's a naval station there now. For the next few days, they continue to launch attacks on the Goeben. She can't get off, and she's got to be, and she's vulnerable. But it's at the centre of the Turkish defences as well, the air defences. And this is what Donald says. They brought up their fighter squadrons and the air was stiff with German fighters. They were attacking our bombers. We got several shot down. The camel's job was to hang around the bombers and keep the fighters off. And I think we got quite a few of them down. A small Halberstadt fighter climbed up to attack Ralph's... I wonder if that's Rafe. Ralph Sawley and Smithy in their DH-4 at an unbelievably steep angle. He was right below me, so I put my old camel into a vertical dive and practically fell on top of him with both Vickers machine guns going. He went down in a queer sort of tumbling spin, but nobody saw him crash. It was one long, confused melee of a dogfight above the Dardanelles. Just one hell of a crowd of aircraft and anti-aircraft shells. Wow. That all happened in places we know. It does not bring it home to you when you could just picture the scene. The wounded battle cruiser being attacked by Allied seaplanes. Now, in the interview, it's hilarious because David Lance keeps asking him, why didn't they sink the Goeben? Why didn't they destroy her? Why do you think, besides all the German and Turkish, they always understate the Turkish element, opposition. Why else do you think that the bombers couldn't sink or severely or blow up the Goeben, Gary? What could stop them?
The Goeben itself, I should imagine. And the fact that it was beached. It was...
And one other thing?
I have no idea.
What do you think the bomb load would be?
Oh, it'd be terrible. And also, you know, actually hitting the thing from that height and whilst you're involved in that sort of action.
And even if you do hit it, you've got a
6-pound bomb, what's it going to do?
65-pound
bomb. Oh, 65
or a 112-pound bomb. It's not going to do much damage to an armour.
Well, you mentioned earlier on the armour that it's had. It's hit a couple of mines and whilst it's had to beach, it's not sunk. So, yeah, that's a good point.
But David never gets this, so he keeps asking, why didn't you sink it? You can hear Donald get more irate.
I didn't get it.
Well, you're lovable, though. Now, so the government stays stranded there until the 26th of January, so it's there about a week. And then it's pulled off and towed back into the Black Sea by the battleship Turgut Reis. Now, so what happens to that's the big excitement. Now, in 1918, Donald's operating from a string of airfields all over the place. Stavros, Mudros, Lemnos, and there. Nice change. Mytilene, that makes it... Oh, no, it's also known as Lesbos. And Thassos. They're not very imaginative with their names for places, are they?
No.
They haven't got one called Chaos, sir.
They're all Greek to me.
Very good, Gary. Very good. And just there's a couple of highlights stand out. Well, there's one here. One thing to remember is from the 1st of April 1918, he's not in the RNAS anymore. What's he in, Gary?
Something far easier to spell and say. The RAF.
The Royal Air Force. Fine body of men and women. Now, the next, we've got one more big excited tale to tell, and that's September 1918. The Bulgarians are finally in retreat. We always say we made them retreat, but more likely the French and Serbians had broken through, and the Bulgarians were in a state of pell-mell retreat, and they were being followed up by the British, the French, and the Serbians. And this is Donald explaining his role, and it's a murderous role too. No warning this time.
Bulgarian army was in full retreat. We didn't know they were going to collapse so quickly, but at last the British army got them on the move. They were retreating through the Rupel Pass, and I'm afraid we caught the poor writers very much on the hop because it was been a key pass. They'd held it through the entire war and we could do nothing about it. But once they started to retreat through it, they were in a horrible trap because we were shooting them up from low down. Well, it was simply a matter of chasing after motor cars, transport lorries, bullock wagons, all the transport they had, marching troops in a narrow valley, and they'd no option but to scramble up a steep side on the ones on the left-hand side or fall over a cliff on the right, and I'm afraid they were doing both. And it wasn't at all a pleasant sight. Nobody enjoyed it, but the fact remains you get an army like that because Johnny Vulgar was a good fighter. You got him on the run, you had to keep him on the run. And it was very largely done with the sop with camels shooting them up like mad from low down.
Can you just imagine that, Gary? The poor old Bulgarians trapped on a narrow road with a sort of cliff on one side going up and a cliff on the other side going down. And nowhere to hide, really.
Extremely vulnerable to attack from the air.
And what happens if you hit a bullock wagon, you kill the bullocks? What, it blocks the road, doesn't it? So they can't get anywhere. It's a terrible thing. Now, that's really the end of our time for him in the First World War, the Great War. But he goes on to a distinguished career, doesn't he? Could you sketch it in a bit, Gary? He's a regular RAF officer by the end of the war. And just give us some idea of what he does.
Yeah, he gets involved in some exciting stuff. He leads a dawn raid on the Bolshevik naval base at Kronstadt during the Baltic campaign and the Russian Civil War.
You don't hear much about that, do you?
No.
And this is one thing about the interview programme. It's not covered because in those days, our interviews would just pick on one sliver of a career. And, of course, that would be we'd super like to hear about that now, wouldn't we?
We would.
What else does he do?
Well, he commands a number of squadrons as well as stints on the directing staff at the RAF Staff College Andover in 1924, I think that was. He commands the School of Naval Cooperation. That's an interesting name. And number one Indian Wing Station at Kohat, India.
I bet that was interesting because those frontier campaigns, they used to have something called a ghoulie chit when they flew. Because they were bombing poor defenceless villages. And if you actually, your aircraft ran out of fuel and crashed, you were in a lot of trouble. They used to chop your ghoulies off. So they had a ghoulie chit and you got money if you handed the pilot back unharmed. So that's
and the last 2 minutes you've mentioned bullocks and ghoulies.
Bullocks to you as well.
Now during the Second World War, he had
that's less exciting.
Yeah, he had a series of staff posts as Director General of Organisation, and then Deputy Air Member for Supply and Organisation, and finally Commander of Maintenance Command in 1942 before retiring in 1947.
What a career, eh? Now, those last posts would sound boring. I'd have liked to have heard about them because although they sound boring, they're bloody important, aren't they? Staff positions at a high level. He had a very important career. So that is Graham Donald for you. I hope you've enjoyed it. You wanted to say something about just how you felt about hearing the man himself and about what happened to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's really intriguing, isn't it, to realise that he was interviewed in 1972, as you say, and, you know, that's within my lifetime. I was, as I said, 10 years old. And the fact that, you know, I used to go to Edinburgh as a child with my family, I could have walked past this man on Princes Street, you know, and not known it. I think it's incredible. And hearing the man's voice, I think we should do more of this, Pete, because actually hearing the people themselves talking about their experiences adds a certain dimension. And when I was reading the notes earlier in the week, I couldn't wait to learn a bit more about Graham Donald. Do you know, for example, how long he lived, Pete? Do you know when he died?
No, I didn't look it up, but it's on the internet. Sorry, that is entirely my fault. I should have looked that up. He was certainly, I think he lived to about 1984.
I think I'll put you on the spot there because you did me with why they couldn't sink the Goeben.
I did do that.
Yeah,
I did do
just that. Mentioning
I apologise unreservedly, Gary. I'd like to say that it's interesting also that David Lance recorded that in 1972, which is 50 years ago. And it was only sort of 54 years before that. We're almost as far from when was recorded as it was. I mean, 54 years from 1972, 50 years from 1972 is 1922, which is only 4 years after the instance, the most exciting instance. And that brings it home to you. If you want to hear more, go to the Imperial War Museum website and type in Graham Donald and IWM. You should be able to find it there. I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. We've loved doing this. And thank you, Gary. Thank you, Gary.
No, thank you, Peter. Thank you. No, thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for everything.
No,
you
thank
do.
You.
Thank you. And thank you, Matt.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gaz.
Gaz?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?